Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, from mold to meth labs, what is a homeowner required to disclose about a property's history before selling it? We get an expert legal opinion. Later in the program, a statewide ban on releasing balloons is now in effect. We discuss its impact with one of the advocates who helped pass the law and a lawmaker opposed to it. But first, what are realtors and sellers legally required to disclose to potential buyers when putting a property up for sale? To discuss that, we're joined by Zachary Roth, a real estate lawyer with Ansbacher Law, which we should note is also a WJCT underwriter. Welcome back, Zach.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So there's a lot of areas we can discuss, but I'm going to start with one that we've gotten a lot of questions about: murder. So if a major crime is committed on your property, in that property, what are you required to tell somebody that might buy it?
Well, this is a good place to start because this is one that's actually kind of black and white. There's very few things in the law that are in this world, but there's a statute actually specifically on point that says you do not have to disclose murders, homicides, or deaths in the property. And the logic behind that is there's nothing wrong with the home because someone's been murdered in it or there's a death. There's a stigma culturally, but the home functions like the home is supposed to. And that's really what the laws about disclosures are intended to deal with, are when the home doesn't function like it's supposed to and a seller maybe tries to hide it. So there's nothing wrong with the home itself because of a potential murder or death that happens in the property. So the law there, the statute is directly on point that says you do not have a duty to disclose that.
There are people, certainly, though, that would argue, I would never buy that home if I knew that this terrible crime had occurred there. There are some really notorious crimes, even in this community, that have happened in homes where people may not have been told. Is there nothing to be made legally of, this just gives me the willies beyond belief, there was a terrible crime committed here, I would never have bought this home?
Legally, no, unless you ask. Now, once you ask the question, they have to answer honestly. So just because they don't have a duty to disclose doesn't mean if you ask, they can lie about it. You still have the idea of misrepresentation, and there's fraudulent misrepresentation when you intentionally know and you intentionally deceive someone. Or you could have negligent misrepresentation where you probably should have known and you misrepresented it based on the fact that you should have known. So if it's something that you're really worried about, this idea that a crime has happened, ask the question. Because once they, I say a lot, you may not have a duty to open your mouth, but once you do, what comes out of it better be true.
Is someone allowed to say, I'm not required to disclose that information, and just simply not answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. But I think if they do that, that probably answers the question. Because I doubt if the answer was no to their knowledge, they would say, I'm not going to answer that. So I think I'm not going to answer that, or a yes is a yes.
Is there no claim that there's an impact on a home's value because of something that occurred there?
I think the law behind it, the idea behind the law is that there shouldn't be, because the home, again, is functioning like it's supposed to. So we're not going to deal with depressed property values because of things that don't actually relate to the home itself. So does it depress the value? Probably. I mean, because there is a cultural stigma. But I think that the logic behind the law is that we're going to kind of draw the line at cultural stigma, because now we're getting into subjective rather than objective. If a roof leaks, the house is objectively wrong. But you may care more about what happened in the house before than I did in terms of events that happened. Where do we draw that line? We can draw the line at the home doesn't function properly, but do we draw the line? Okay, so murders are bad. We have to disclose murders. What about armed robberies? What about arson? Where does the line stop? So I think the logic is there's a clear demarcation we can make in terms of the physical condition of the property. Let's make the line there so it's black and white.
And just to ask one more detail about that, you know, there's sometimes these crime shows that come up years later. Perhaps people wouldn't have known about something that happened many years ago, but then all of a sudden there's a news crew outside because there's a new break in the case or a cold case that's been resolved. There's nothing, even at that point, to protect somebody from saying, you know, this is impacting my quality of life, this is impacting my privacy.
Yeah, legally, no. I don't really think that there is, because even if theoretically, at that point, you had a misrepresentation claim or something like that, there's a pretty good chance your statute of limitations is going to be expired to the extent you ever had a claim anyway. So the longer time goes, the less and less your rights are, even if they were very small to begin with.
So let's talk about a couple of other things. I mean, we're going to talk about what is required to be disclosed. What about meth labs? We know that there, you know, is lingering pollution. It can have health impacts on people who move into a home that was used to produce methamphetamine.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've actually been asked that question before. My opinion is that you would need to disclose that because it's not just a stigma in that case. You mentioned the health effects. I think the story that I was asked about before was that a young child, this was not in Florida, but a young child tested positive for meth. And so the parents were arrested, but they tested the parents and the parents didn't. And they found out that it was chemicals still in the HVAC system of the home.
Wow.
Resulting from the creation of the meth in the meth lab. That's a real problem with the home. That's not a matter of, well, I don't like that it used to be a meth lab. So in my opinion, that is a material fact affecting the value of the property that should be disclosed.
Is the fact that it could have health impacts, does that take it beyond just a claim about the house's condition, it being a real estate matter? I mean, I know I've seen some research where, you know, there's behavioral problems, sleep disruption that can be caused by this exposure to a methamphetamine, you know, pollutant.
I'm not sure it changes what your claim would be, especially in Florida, because Florida is so limited in the personal injury space in terms of this idea of the contact rule and there having to be physical contact. It's possible that if you can get a doctor to establish causation, which is always the hardest part, is establishing that causation, that that could be part of your damages for the claim of non-disclosure. But you're probably limited to your real estate remedies there, I would think. Maybe a negligence claim, but probably not.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about what home buyers are entitled to know before they buy a home. And if you have a question about that, you can join us on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. In addition to the, you know, you said black and white when it comes to requirement, no requirement to disclose murder, there's also a specifically non-disclosure if somebody there had HIV, which I think is an interesting.
Yeah, it's actually in the same statute about murders. It says that if a prior resident had HIV or AIDS, you do not have that duty to disclose either.
Yeah, and you are not required to answer that question, but if somebody asks you?
Again, you have to answer honestly.
You have to answer honestly, okay. Yeah. So let's talk about Florida's legal requirements, both in terms of statutory requirements and what case law has established about what you have to disclose.
Sure. And I'll start with the case law because that really established the law with regard to sellers. And then the law regarding real estate agents kind of tracks that law through statute. So the statute almost was created to say, yeah, that duty that was created by the Supreme Court, you have that duty as well, agents. Which, so there's this case from 1985 called Johnson versus Davis. Johnson versus Davis was a Florida Supreme Court case where the seller did not disclose roof leaks. It's a roof leak case is the essential. And so I always use that as the essential example. They didn't disclose it. They painted over the evidence that it leaked and they sold it. And the Florida Supreme Court said, we used to follow caveat emptor, which means buyer beware. Buyer, you're responsible for the condition. Do your inspections, which is still the law on commercial properties. And actually commercial transactions is an important caveat to make to that. I can explain that difference momentarily. But it said in a residential transaction, the seller has an affirmative duty to disclose matters known to the seller that materially affect the value of the property that are not readily observable to the buyer. So an example I use is a broken window. A broken window is readily observable. You don't have to disclose a broken window if the glass is shattered. Another example I use is a burned out light bulb. That's not material. It doesn't affect the value of the property. You can go and get a $2 light bulb and change that. So roof leaks are a big example. Window leaks, if you've got moisture in the walls, is a big example. You could have issues with the property that have flooding because that may not be readily observable. If we're in a dry period when the process of the sale is going on and the seller knows that, yeah, when it rains a lot, it floods, that definitely could be something that could be a cause for disclosure or a claim for non-disclosure. And then the statutes say that real estate agents have that same duty. It basically verbatim tracks that language of facts materially affecting the value of the property. They're not readily observable to the buyer.
So are the disclosure requirements for a real estate agent and a homeowner basically the same?
Yes, essentially. They're intended, the statute for agents is intended to track the requirement for the seller. So it is almost a parallel disclosure obligation. If one has the duty, the other is going to have it as well.
And liability is the same for each?
Yeah, generally, which is essentially the, it can be measured in different ways. Typically, it's the cost to repair whatever the issue is. But you could have an argument that it's economic waste to make the repair. And so it would be the diminution in value of the home. How much is it worth without the issue versus with the issue? Those are really your two biggest ways of measuring the damages: change in value, cost to fix.
We've got a call from John in Riverside. Good morning, John. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. I can kind of understand the idea that a murder happening in a house doesn't affect the quality of the house, except as we're sitting here, I've lived in Riverside for 40 years. There was a murder maybe 600 feet from my house. I won't go into too many details about it, but long and short, a woman and her infant son were killed. The manner the child died was horrible, and it's identifiable by a location in the house. Now, just sitting here remembering this murder has got me in a bit of a turmoil this morning. I can't imagine being in that house and the spot where the child was murdered and the manner the child did. It's hard enough for me. This was like 25 years ago, and just thinking about it today has got me upset. I can't imagine living in it. I have to say, I think it would affect the quality of the house. I don't know what you do. You can't make the house a shrine to those two victims. But again, it's a real factor. If they don't have to disclose it, I think real estate agents should at least inform their clients to ask. There was a murder, a friend of mine was murdered three houses away, but it was entirely different situations. So I think it would depend on the event that happened. There's some things so horrible that you really couldn't live with them.
And John, do you know, is that house occupied and does the homeowner know about that incident?
I do not know. It's definitely occupied. And I've lived here 40 years. I'm trying to think of how long ago it was. Okay. It could be a factor. All I can say is, I guess I would never buy another house. The chance of me moving over there would be unusual.
Without asking.
I would never buy a house without asking.
Thank you, John. Appreciate that. I mean, I think that goes to the fact, you know, that there is this sliding scale of what's acceptable or what's not. He referenced two different cases. He said they're so different.
Right. Yeah. I think that's exactly it. We can draw the line on that. The roof isn't supposed to leak. That's not what roofs do, but it does versus these different factors in every case. And I think John actually made a really good point of, and I think this is a little bit of the logic behind the law as well. We can't make this house a shrine. So if we take something that, again, the house functions just like the house is supposed to, and we say that every time this happens, you have a duty to disclose it, we could end up with all these properties that end up vacant, even though the house is fine itself. It's just cultural stigma. And so it goes back to you can fix a broken roof. You can't change what happened in the house. And so you are almost condemning that house to perpetual failure if you're setting up this duty to disclose that. I think there'd be an argument for that.
I think, too, there has been a few cases around Jacksonville I can think of where there was high-profile crimes where the homes were destroyed afterwards, you know, where terrible things had happened. I particularly recall in Clay County when the young girl, Summer Thompson, was kidnapped and murdered, and the house where the perpetrator lived and where the murder occurred, I think, was set on fire by the fire department there as a kind of training exercise. So,
yeah, I think that actually happens a lot throughout the country, that when you have these horrible places where horrible things have happened, the reset button may be the way that everyone goes about it.
We've got a call from Robert in Fernandina Beach. Good morning, Robert. Go ahead.
Yes, how are you this morning?
Great. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, I'm wondering, the gentleman's talking about what needs to be disclosed if you're buying a home and the person's gone, the realtor, they should disclose, I would imagine, if they had pets and they made terrible messes, especially cats.
Yeah, interesting question, Robert. What do you say?
I would say probably, having two cats myself, that's probably readily observable if you're dealing with those type of issues, because you probably smell it the minute you walk in. Mm-hmm. And so that's not a hidden issue. The law of disclosure is really designed to prevent people from duping people into buying properties and selling them properties with issues they can't find out about themselves, even if they exercise reasonable diligence. I think if you're talking about prior pet damage, you're probably going to notice that the minute you walk into the home, if it's significant enough to affect the value of the property.
We have an email, and I guess it's worth clarifying, because I think that perhaps we were not clear when we were talking about the HIV requirement. This person who's writing is a loan compliance specialist, and she says, how does a previous owner having HIV not fall under HIPAA? Common knowledge that nobody's required to disclose that information upon inquiry. So I guess her question is, if somebody asks, you're not required to disclose, but if somebody asks if somebody who lived there had HIV, she's saying that that would be HIPAA protected and not required to be disclosed.
Yeah, that's a very common misunderstanding of what HIPAA applies to. HIPAA applies to healthcare institutions, organizations, and what they can do with your health information. It doesn't apply to private citizens.
Yeah, people often think that they're constrained about what they can say about someone's health condition, but that really does apply only to people
in the healthcare world, right?
Okay. Email from Andrew. He says, if your COA board is contentious and refractory, does the seller of a condo have an obligation to tell that to a potential buyer? That's a condo owners association.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that's a matter. Again, it goes back to the idea of black and white versus gray. And what I find to be a contentious condo board, or what you find, I may not find that, given that our firm represents condos and I see how often things like that happen. I may say that's just kind of how these things normally work. The unit itself functions like it's supposed to, so I don't think that falls under the disclosure requirement.
You are required to say, though, if you do have a homeowners association or a condo owners association, you're required to disclose fees and things like that?
That's right. Yeah, there's explicit statutes, Chapter 718 for condos, 720 for HOAs, that specifically set out what a seller has to disclose.
What about things like boundary disputes? You know, if you have your neighbor has been battling over where that fence line is, home damage from something like a termite infestation?
I think those are probably two different answers.
Okay.
So taking the termite infestation, I think that's definitely something that materially affects the value of the home and could easily be hidden. So it wouldn't be readily observable. So I definitely think if you've got that hidden and the buyer couldn't see it, you definitely have a duty there to disclose that. On the boundary disputes, that's an interesting one, right? Especially on a fence, because on the one hand, a buyer may not be able to tell how significant the fight between the neighbors has been. But on the other hand, a survey will probably tell you where that fence is and may tell you, hey, you should be aware that there might be something here you need to ask about. So I'm not sure if that one meets the readily observable element or not readily observable element. I think that would be a very fact-intensive inquiry.
But there's a requirement to disclose if there's a legal issue pending, right? I mean, that could fall under that if you and your lawyer, you and your neighbor are at a point where there could be litigation over the boundary.
Well, there's actually some case law that talks about if it's in the public records and court records or public records, that's readily observable to a buyer.
Interesting.
Because we all have access to it. Now, it's crazy to think we would all go into it, but there is law that says that if it's out there, the buyer is aware of it.
We have an email from Nancy. She says, if you get a home inspection that turns out okay, but then as soon as you move in your home, it needs a new AC system and all new plumbing. Do you have any recourse? It sounds like this may be something she has personal experience with.
I think you're talking about maybe three different types of recourse. One is, did your inspector do a good job? You may have recourse there if they didn't do what they were supposed to do. A lot of inspectors include in their contracts with you that your damages are limited to what you paid them. So a lot of times you're just asking for your money back. And then you have a question of, well, did the seller know about it? And then, as we said, it's kind of a parallel disclosure obligation. So when I say there's three of the seller and the real estate agents, did they know about it? And could you have known about it? Again, the facts are always very specific there. And when I bought my home, the day I moved in, the upstairs air conditioning unit stopped working. So I am
happens to the best of you.
There on, with you on that, there's that they had to know, right? But how do you prove it is another really, really, really tough element. I always say really usually the hardest element is proving that the seller knew about it. they usually don't send an email that says, hey, the roof leaks, but don't tell anybody.
Right. We have a question from MG via email. What about the real estate agent being required to disclose sexual predators or offenders in proximity to the home?
I'm not certain about the specific examples, like where the line is exactly on that. I haven't had the occasion to have to deal with that. But there are certain statutory requirements on what has to be known. And because it has to be available on a public website, I think that would fall under the what's known. Again, it doesn't affect the value of the property itself. So I think that would fall on the buyer's due diligence.
Got a call from Tracy in Live Oak. Good morning, Tracy. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Hi, good morning. I am in the process of looking at buying a condo, but my husband is a ex-felon, nonviolent, and I want to know if HOA can prevent me and him from buying a condo.
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of that they can prohibit felons, you know, especially a nonviolent felon. I don't think there's any law that says they can.
Okay. Federally required disclosures include lead, right? If your home was built a certain...
Before 1974.
Okay. And that's sort of when they stopped using lead-based paints?
Correct.
Are there other federal disclosure requirements?
That's the main one. You do, and this is more when you get into commercial properties, but you do have maybe not necessarily disclosure, but obligations on the part of the buyer to investigate the environmental history of the property. Mm-hmm. But again, that's on the commercial side, so the seller doesn't have disclosure obligations. But really the main one on the federal side is that lead-based paint.
We have a email. No, I guess we don't have it. It's just a question. What about selling a house as is? I know that there's some requirements under the law.
Yeah, that's a very misunderstood term. A lot of people think I'm selling it as is, basically caveat emptor, the buyer beware. I don't have a Johnson versus Davis responsibility.
Which is the disclosure.
The disclosure requirement. Obligation, right. That's not actually what selling it as is means. Selling it as is means I'm not doing repairs. You can take it or leave it. But selling it as is does not mean you don't have to make the disclosures. It's two different things. The as is has to do with the physical condition, but it doesn't abrogate disclosures. If you're in a position where you may not have knowledge, you live in Washington State, and the property's been leased out to tenants for the last 25 years, and you've never stepped foot in the property, that may be a mitigating factor in Johnson versus Davis, what you could know about the property, the disclosures. I think you would want to include that in your contract. The buyer acknowledges the seller hasn't been in the property in 25 years and doesn't know anything about the physical condition of the property. Or another example is you have a lot of times tenants lease properties and then buy them from their landlord. I think you would put in the contract, the tenant's the one that knows about the condition of the property because they've lived in it, so they waive any liability I would have for the condition of the property. So I think that's really where you're getting into this idea of it's as is, as the knowledge is, I don't have the knowledge, and buyer, I want it in our contract. You agree that that's the case.
Let's talk about flooding. You mentioned that, you know, if a home repeatedly floods, has a tendency to flood, you would think that that would be required disclosure. But what about, you know, we're seeing more and more of these sort of 100-year, 500-year floods. If it flooded once and it was the first time, but it, you know, flooded badly or significantly, are you required to disclose that?
I think it depends on the nature of the event. You know, if it was a hurricane and it flooded, I don't think that's a defect with the home. A lot of homes are going to flood in hurricanes. You know, a lot of times you get leaks through roof vents in hurricanes because you get horizontally blown rain. That's not a defect in the home. It's working how it's supposed to. They're not hurricane proof. They're not designed to be 100% water resistant to hurricanes. So I don't think you're going to have a duty there. But if you're talking about on your typical heavy Florida rainstorm day, it's going to flood, that's an issue with the property. It shouldn't flood every time.
What about, though, I mean, we think of a car, if it's been flooded out, that it's kind of permanently compromised, right? What about a home? Does it not suffer some sort of permanent value, you know, being compromised?
It depends on the damage that occurs. You know, and I think this hits on a key point, is just because it has had an issue doesn't mean it currently has one that has to be disclosed. If you repair the issue and you remedy it, I don't think you have to disclose that, hey, it used to have this problem, but I fixed it. I always make the argument and take the position that if the issue existed and it's been remedied, the home is actually worth more. So there's not an item materially affecting the value of the property because the home's worth more than it was worth before. And so if it flooded, I repair the damage inside and I fix the drainage outside, I don't think I have to disclose that. Now, if it floods and I just close my eyes, it's a different question.
What about coastal erosion?
That probably is not something that falls under Johnson versus Davis required disclosures, only because that is observable. We all know that the coastline erodes. If you're buying a home on Ponte Vedra Boulevard, for example, where we see the stilt homes that wash out a lot in hurricanes, that's readily observable, I think. That's the position I would take. I'm not aware that there is a specific case on that point. There might be. I haven't encountered it if there is. But I would argue that you probably know that sand washes out when there's a big storm.
Yeah. But there are places where it's washed away and then it's been renourished, and perhaps with the understanding that that's going to continue to happen. But you think that that, again, is just sort of understood?
Well, and I think it's also public record, right? All this beach renourishment occurs based on government projects and easements a lot of times that are given by the property owners for the work to be done. So if we're charging owners with knowledge of what's in the public record, which is what the law says we do, I think you're probably on notice that it's had this past and it's been renourished. And so it probably is not hidden.
What about mold?
Mold is really more of a symptom, because mold doesn't exist by itself. Mold exists because of moisture. The moisture getting in is the problem. So I think the two kind of go hand in hand. If you have a water leak that's resulting in mold, you probably have the duty to disclose the mold because you have the duty to disclose the water leak. But if you don't have a water leak, you probably don't have mold. So I think it's more the existence of the mold demonstrates that there is a issue materially affecting the value of the property rather than the mold itself being the issue.
Gotcha. Got a call from Justin in San Marco. Good morning, Justin. Go ahead.
Hey, it's Jason. Thank you so much. I want to say a couple of things. First, I just want everyone to know out there that realtors in the state of Florida are required to have continuing education every 2 years or they cannot practice real estate. And I know there are a lot of professions, including the medical profession, that do not require you to take a state exam and pass it in order to keep practicing medicine. And I want to say I really appreciate the information that your guest is providing, and that I think it's a pretty darn good advertisement for the concept of using an experienced professional realtor, an experienced professional attorney to close the transaction, and the best inspection company you can find. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Sorry for messing up your name. And I guess that's true, although not necessarily foolproof in any respect.
Yeah, it's never going to be foolproof. Typically, if a party is undertaking an affirmative effort to hide things, they're doing it on purpose. It's not typical that they accidentally don't disclose it. It's usually intentional. And in that case, I agree completely with the idea of having, you know, professionals help you. Like that, I agree with Jason 100% on that. But doing their best, they may still miss things if they've done a good job of trying to hide it. The roof leak is the perfect example. If an inspector goes in and sees that everything's been patched and it's all clean and there's no active moisture, they may not know that the next time it rains, it's going to leak again.
Gotcha. Well, Zach Roth, thank you so much for coming on the program to answer these questions. I'm sure we'll have you back another time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Up next, a plan to reduce marine pollution puts an end to releasing balloons. That you bought today, staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love songs all night long. Call me, only for welcome back. A years-long effort to reduce plastic pollution in Florida waters got a legislative boost this session when lawmakers voted to ban deliberate balloon releases. The law took effect yesterday, and here to talk about what it means, I'm joined by Hunter Miller, St. Augustine-based field campaigns manager for the International Ocean Conservation Group, Oceana. Welcome, Hunter.
Thanks so much. Great to be here, Anne.
Great to have you. In just a minute, we're going to be joined by State Representative Angie Nixon to talk about this same issue. But Hunter, how significant is this moment?
Well, Oceana and our allies are celebrating this moment. As you said, we've been working to pass this law for 3 years, and we've worked in local communities to pass ordinances building up to this moment. And I think it's a really big win for wildlife, our beaches, and some of our most vulnerable marine species. Balloons really pose a significant risk to animals like sea turtles, marine mammals like manatees and dolphins. And so when we can pass a policy like this in a bipartisan way, I think we can save animals' lives and make Florida a little bit more beautiful.
Explain why it is a threat. Why does it pose a hazard in particular to these marine creatures?
Yeah, so balloons are attractive. And when we release one or, you know, hundreds of them, they go up in the air and they have to come back down. They can travel thousands of miles. They can end up not only in our oceans and our sand dunes, but in some of the most pristine and remote places in our state. You know, when they're in the water, particularly for sea turtles, they resemble jellyfish, which are some of their favorite foods. And when they eat these balloons, they can be cause a lot of problems. They can get impacted in the digestive system and can even be fatal. And then also the ribbons attached to balloons, they can entangle lots of different species. It's not just sea turtles. It's our shorebirds and lots of different types of wildlife, but even livestock like cows and horses can mistake these balloons for food and become sick or even die from ingestion.
And I saw that a statistic that between 2008 and 2016, nearly 300,000 balloons were found along U.S. beaches. I personally know the number's higher because I never reported the ones I picked up, and I pick them up all the time. So they are very common sighting on the beach.
Yeah, and I think, too, we got to remember, I think, you know, for Oceana, we are working to address the larger issue of plastic pollution. And so while balloons, they're a part of that, the thing about balloons is that they're one of the most deadly forms of plastic pollution. So, you know, I think that's why this is such an important law, is that they're just particularly dangerous for some of our most vulnerable species.
And explain to us, the previous law that was in place statewide in Florida allowed up to 9 balloons per person to be released, you know, by a person within a 24-hour period without penalty. That is now, there is no exemption like that?
Well, until yesterday, yeah, you're right. Individual could release up to 10 balloons per day. There was also an exemption for so-called biodegradable balloons, so an unlimited release of those. And so, you know, I think knowing what we know, I think that's too much. I think zero is the appropriate number if we want to take into account, you know, the science and what we know about the harms that balloons can cause. So, yeah, we're really happy about that. The new law does exempt children 6 and under. And it's now treated as litter under Florida's litter statute. So if you were cited for this infraction, it would be the same as throwing a bag of trash out your window in your car.
So it's a $150 fine per violation. Is that per balloon, do you know, or is that per kind of incident?
I don't know the exact answer to that. I would expect it to be the per release. I think that would be up for interpretation.
Okay. So this recent vote that was, as you said, bipartisan, there were only 9 no votes in the state house, and 5 of those were Black legislators who argued that the law will disproportionately impact Black Floridians. To talk about that, let's bring in State Representative Angie Nixon. Angie, you were one of those votes against this. Can you explain why you voted no and what your concern is?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. And for sure. And so I want to be clear that I am totally in support of doing things to help improve and save the overall environment. However, we had conversations with the bill sponsor just in regards to trying to put amendments on the bill that would at least allow for things like a warning and that type of thing while folks learn more about this bill, because oftentimes in the Black community, at funerals or at anniversaries of or remembrances of death and things like that, folks release balloons, right? And it is nothing with malicious intent, but they release balloons to symbolize that life. And so we were really trying to get them to at least run an aggressive campaign to let folks know that this bill was passing, because we are concerned that it is going to disproportionately impact members of the Black community. I believe we even asked, was it going to be per balloon or per release? And it's so vague. The bill is so vague. And so, again, like, we are totally in support of the overall idea of the bill. But just right now, there is no media campaign. There is no awareness around it. And we're just concerned that Black people are going to be targeted in regards to it.
And Representative Nixon, it is true. There are many events, I think, in the Black community, particularly here in Jacksonville, where a balloon release really is an integral part of that event. And I know that when I worked at the TV station, we would cover, for instance, if there was a crime memorial, that there would typically be a balloon release. And that was, you know, a very emotional event and an important part of that observance. But we often discussed, even within the station, you know, should we add a codicil to this coverage to say that is illegal? And a lot of people found that would be insensitive. But what is your feeling about the best way to let people know about this law change?
Right. So what I'm going to do, and what many of the other legislators have decided to do, is to reach out to different funeral homes and different organizations that work with victims of crime to let them know. And, like, also, you know, just no offense, but I know folks may say, oh, well, we're talking about it now. But let's be honest, like, this is the workday. These are normal working hours for working class families, and it's a privilege to be able to listen to this show at this time. And so, like, we have to try to get the message out on all avenues of media, social media, regular media, traditional media, all the things. But I am going to do my part as well, you know, posting and letting folks know whenever I'm out at community meetings and that type of thing, that this is law. And I mean, it is going to be a good thing, but I also just don't want to unintentionally hurt folks that just don't know. They don't know the negative impacts that releasing balloons have on the environment. And so we really have to work diligently to really raise awareness across the state about it.
I'll take this opportunity just to remind folks that we also are a podcast. So if you miss an episode or you don't hear the broadcast, you can subscribe and it will drop in your feed every day and you won't miss an episode. I want to take a call, though, from Charles on the West Side. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Representative Nixon, you know, maybe have an event or something at James Weldon Johnson Park and have a local musician, you know, compose a rap song about, you know, don't be a buffoon and release a balloon, you know, and have that as, you know, an addendum to your campaign of town meetings, et cetera, to get the word out there.
Charles, with a pitch for a song, what do you say, Representative Nixon?
Potentially. But yeah, no, we're definitely going to continue to try to spread the word. I know I am working to do some partnering on different types of events with the Sierra Club. And so this is something that we can definitely incorporate into it as well.
I know one of your colleagues during the discussion and the debate over this was saying that it would be important to communicate this with funeral homes and, you know, funeral service providers. Is there any effort? Is that something that you plan to do?
Yeah, I stated earlier, yes, we'll definitely be reaching out to the funeral homes in the area, particularly those that are in the Black community especially. So there are a few in my district as well. And so going to send out a memo to them and have my staff not only email them and call, but actually drop something off to them as well.
Terrific. We have a call from Tiffany. Good morning, Tiffany, on the West Side. Go ahead.
Good morning. My question is, I wonder if it would be possible, since we are seeing that, of course, you know, a lot of event planners in the city are also African-American. A lot of families purchase balloons from the grocery stores, Publix. They also go to Dollar Tree. They also go to Party City. I wonder if it would be possible to even post something up in those grocery stores, those businesses, and possibly hand something out to those businesses as well. Thank you.
That's a good question, Tiffany. Hunter, what do you think about that? Is there an opportunity to put up some signage to let people know about the new law?
Well, I think it's a great idea. I also know that Party City, which was a proponent of this law, huge distributor of balloons, already has signage. When they're selling balloons, there is a sign that really discourages folks from intentionally releasing balloons. So that does exist, and there should be more of that. I think that's a great idea.
We've got a call from AJ. Good morning, AJ. Go ahead.
Hey, this is AJ with Mad Dads. Good morning, everybody. And I think that law has been in effect in Duval for a while. So what Mad Dads do when families reach out to us, we tell them that it's a law. Most people are not aware that it's a law. But most of the families that we have served, they understand, and we just end up doing like a candlelight visual for the families. But most of the families that Mad Dads has educated on the bloom and the environmental effect on it has been very receptive of it.
Thanks for the work that you do, AJ. Thanks for calling in. The shift here, Hunter, as he notes, is a statewide change in the law, but Oceana has been working for a while to get communities one by one to pass some of these laws. And as he noted, it's currently already illegal in Jacksonville. So catch us up on what the piecemeal laws were and what this changes.
Yeah, happy to. Well, I think, you know, some of our best policies come from our cities and towns and counties. And that's certainly the case with this issue. In October of 2022, Jacksonville City Council passed an ordinance banning the intentional release of balloons. I think it passed 15-1. And we also saw St. John's County, St. Augustine, Flagler County, and then other cities and municipalities around the state passing these laws. So I think that was born out of folks just kind of fed up with finding balloons in their neighborhoods, blighting their neighborhoods, and also in our waterways. And so I think that built the foundation for the call to action to do something more at the state level. So we have an existing policy that's clear and that covers, you know, the entire state.
Well, it's a good conversation. Hunter Miller from Oceana, Representative Angie Nixon, thanks so much for joining us on the line. We appreciate it. Thanks for talking about it.
Thanks so much.
Up next, a community baseball rivalry with a turn of the century twist.
Legacies of Sri Lanka's long civil war, a host of people injured by violence. As amputees, they face challenges other Sri Lankans don't.
In our country's context, I feel like if you have a disability, you are more vulnerable, unfortunately.
Add to that other pressures like floods and landslides. Disabled by war in a country prone to climate change, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that local governments can punish unhoused people for camping outside. The majority wrote that ticketing and jailing people for violating a local law is not cruel and unusual punishment. What that could mean for the 650,000 unhoused people across the country, next time on Today Explained.
tonight at 6:30 here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. We'll mark 60 years since the Civil Rights Act with Elaine Lee Turner. She and her sister were named the most arrested civil rights family in America.
We would picket the department stores that did not hire blacks as cashiers because that was just for the whites, of course.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today, starting at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
School's out, summer's here. But for students whose college abruptly closed in the spring, this season is anything but relaxing. It's no secret that many institutions are struggling financially. New reporting says colleges are shutting down rapidly, at least one every week. What happens to students and faculty when their college closes? And why are so many of these institutions finding it difficult to stay open? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. The 4th of July weekend is almost upon us, and there is nothing quite as celebratory and all-American as a neighborhood baseball game. As it happens, Springfield is celebrating the holiday with its 17th annual throwback baseball game. Here to tell us about it and this old-timey tradition is Michael Haskins. He's the executive director of SPAR, the Springfield Preservation and Revitalization Council. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you for having me. And yes, we are very excited for the July 4th baseball game, 10 a.m. Clutho Park in historic Springfield, presented by M&M Homes.
So you say this is the 17th year. It started in 2007. How did it get going?
It was originally a group of neighbors who, if you have been in Springfield, it's divided into East and West by Main Street. And so the neighbors like to have friendly competitions. And that evolved into the baseball game to determine each year who is the best side or which is the best side of Springfield, East or West. And from there, it's grown into a
tradition. Has that been decisively answered, which is the best side?
I can't say that it has. It's been a very good back and forth contest.
Okay.
So we'll see who wins it for at least another year.
When did the whole like old-timey turn of the last century element come in?
So Springfield's a historic neighborhood, and I think that the residents had this idea that it would be a good way to honor the history of the neighborhood, which I think makes a lot of sense. And it has evolved into kind of increasingly authentic. So they wear wool uniforms. They use wooden bats. They use the five-finger gloves that were authentic to that time and era. And they are very, very committed to kind of keeping that spirit alive.
I think they could have been forgiven if they skipped the wool uniform for a July 4th baseball game. That seems like an unnecessary masochism.
But try convincing them of that. They love it. And so I think that they just have a really great time. And it adds a certain kind of element of fun to the whole
event.
Hopefully
they have a great dry cleaner. So you said wooden bats, five-finger gloves. What else? There's sort of like announcers that would have been perhaps in the day similar.
We get into it. So we have an organist who will play.
Oh, wow.
The national anthem will be sung by a barbershop quartet. And there's a announcer, a local resident named Kenny, who does it in kind of the outfit of a baseball announcer from that period of time, as well as kind of the voice and style. He imitates them. And he's really fun to listen to.
So how has it been stacking up in recent years, East Side versus West Side? Does one typically dominate?
It has been back and forth. West Side has won the last 2 years, and so East Side is looking to take back the trophy. I think that East Side has very good odds this year, unfortunately due to an injury on the West Side, but that's how it goes. You know, you play with the hand you're dealt, and East Side looks like they're going to have a good chance this year.
Is there? Do you know over all the 17 years, is there like a scoreboard that's kept over who's won and who's won most?
We do have that. We have a trophy from this all 17 years. I haven't gone and added it up. I really should and see. I represent all of the neighborhood, and I love both East and West Side. So I don't want to wage too deeply into that. But I will say that we keep the trophy at Strings, which is where our after party will be. And you can go check it out and count it up for yourself if you would like to.
And Strings is a bar on Main Street, we should say, a restaurant.
That's right. They're a sports brewery with restaurant, and they will be offering the after party. They also keep the original scoreboard from the baseball field when it was originally built. And we have a ceremony where we will write the scores from the game on the scoreboard.
Are there like mid-game hijinks I kind of think about like with minor league ball?
Absolutely. We'll start at 10 a.m. with pregame festivities, mainly for families and children. We run the bases. We play catch in the outfield. We'll have a seventh inning stretch program. And throughout, we will have, of course, that live organist and announcer. And you are welcome to go to food trucks. We'll have a bar there so that you can buy beverages and a couple vendors so you can kind of enjoy the entire picnic-like atmosphere.
And so let's talk about what people ought to bring, because as we noted already, I mean, it's hot outside.
July is known in Florida for being a little bit warm. I would say we recommend treating it like a picnic. Bring camping chairs. If you have a canopy or tent, that makes for a great way to create some shade, sunscreen, sunglasses, hats, and treat it like a summer picnic.
There are bleachers there, though, correct?
There are bleachers. Seating is limited. Most of the time, people choose to use camping chairs to offset that.
And do you have to be a member, you have to be a resident to be on either team, or what are the limitations?
So the rules to play on a team are you have to have a house on the side that you're playing for, that you represent. The rules to attend the event are that it's free for anyone to attend, and we open it to the entire community. The joke is that they will have some interesting recruiting practices. So if someone has a second home that they rent out, oh, maybe they can play for both sides. There was a player who used to play for JU this year who stands to reason he's going to be a pretty good player that is newly recruited to the team. So we'll see how he does. But that was definitely a big recruitment focus for the team during the offseason.
Well, it sounds like a great time. July 4th at Clutho Park. Michael Haskins with SPAR, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight, or you can subscribe to the show on any podcast platform. Our executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett and directed by Brady Quorum. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. Join us tomorrow when we talk to author and Florida native Hamilton Nolan about why he thinks the solution to economic inequality is union solidarity. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
You could see her there every day, shout hooray when they'd play. Her boyfriend by the name of Joe said to Coney Isle, dear, let's go. Then Nellie started to fret and pout, and to him I heard her shout.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.